Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. This podcast is dedicated to mental wellness for first responders and beyond. Through powerful stories, personal experiences, and expert insights, we explore the challenges and triumphs of maintaining resilience in the face of adversity. Together, we remind you, no one fights alone.
Ben, we're back at the No One Fights Alone podcast. Good to see you back, man.
Welcome back. Thanks.
Yep. Having a guest on today from the United States military, U.S. Army, active duty, Chad Balestrazzi. Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast, man.
Brad, Ben, thank you very much.
Man, we had a moment there where we were like, are we going to get our schedules lined up? And it was, and then when you actually offered, said, Ben's having trouble, we can reschedule. I'm like, no, we can't do this. We've had so much trouble with our schedules. Like, no, Ben will get it. Give him a second. We're all good. Ben's ironed out. So it's great having you on. We've been talking about this for a little bit. Just to give the listeners a quick background, and then we'll let you tell us all about your passion projects. Chad is active duty U.S. Army, 18 years, reconnaissance scout to special operations, 5 combat tours, currently at Fort Bragg, married for closing on 17 years. And has 2 wonderful children, one of which has a birthday today. The yep. Pressing question on the marriage is, what are you doing for her for Valentine's Day tomorrow? Or did you even remember?
I mean, we remembered, right? We're doing the typical husband thing. And I got a few hours till the clock strikes midnight. So I got to, and it's not the right answer, but having a daughter, our daughter's birthday is today, like you mentioned. And, You can't ever lump anything together. And my wife's birthday typically falls on Mother's Day. So, you know, it's something I'm working on, but yeah, my sister's in town too. So I've got the whammy all across the board.
Well, I mean, you do get some grace because you've only had, almost 17 years to practice this. So, you know, it's pretty fresh.
Yeah.
Well, from someone who's been doing it for over 25, all I see is lose. There's no way you're going to walk out of this unscathed.
No.
I'm just kidding. Yeah. That's awesome.
Well, Chad, let us take us on a little bit of a journey. You have a really fascinating story and you really have a really fascinating passion project, which is beyond the trek. But we'll get to that. But give us a little bit of a background on Chad and how Chad Balestrazzi was formed.
So I'm originally from Sonoma County, California. I was born and raised there, and it was a great place to grow up. For a lot of people that, you know, I've never visited California, right? Like, there is really nice parts. They're not all, you know, they're not all crazy, but man, I grew up in what I think is a, looking back on it now, you know, a very fortunate childhood. I mean, I had 2 families. My mom and dad's side of the family that were, you know, very loving. My mom's side of the family, very big into, you know, school, college, getting a very good profession. My dad's side of the family was the complete opposite. My grandfather dropped out of high school. Him and my grandmother had kids when they were 16, started their family. He worked 3 jobs and just work, right? You better have a good work ethic. So I grew up doing that. And as I was going through school, I did not like school, right? And as you're growing up as a kid, everybody's different. My parents went through a very, very nasty divorce. I mean, we're talking in 98, 99, they were going through a divorce. And when it was all said and done, it cost about $100,000. Remember my dad talking about that. And, you know, you look at that number now, and I mean, that's a lot of money now, but you look back 20 years ago and that's a lot.
Yeah.
And my dad always used to tell me, like, man, it was worth it because of you guys, but it was all money spent for nothing. And so growing up, when they got divorced, I was just going back and forth. Both of my parents moved in with their parents. So here I was I started off with my mom in a very religious household. And they were big on, like, hey, go to school. And school's not my forte. So when I got to visit my dad, his family, right, was like, hey, we're going to work and you're going to have fun. And I was like, man, this is what I want to do. Like, this seems cool. So I went back and forth a little bit and then finally moved in with my dad, and then stayed there until all through high school. And then I joined the military. Now, my dad, alcoholism runs on my dad's side of the family. Addiction does. And for him, it was alcoholism. And he drank a lot. Now, there were a lot of good times. There was a lot of good times when he didn't drink. And then there was a lot of times when he drank, and he was allergic to alcohol. So he would flip a switch. It would either be really good or really bad. And then he would never remember it. So it was a very much like an emotional roller coaster. And it was so weird being a kid, because when I would get picked up from school, it was like I knew. I would get like this gut feeling, and it was super weird. And I was very rarely wrong on, like, man, when I get in the car, what is this going to be like? So I didn't know what I wanted to do. And in my senior year of high school, they had the option. You could stop going to school halftime. You could go to work, and then you could take some college classes. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. Less school. Let's do it. Well, I flunked out of all of that because I just didn't go. And again, with my dad's side of the family, it was very much like, have a good work ethic. So my dad always just said, hey, you need to get good grades, but he never pressed it on me. So thank God for my wife of almost 17 years, because we were dating at the time, and she's the one that helped me through school, her and her mom and dad.
Way to go, Tawny.
Yeah, man, she's been there through a lot. So I didn't know what I wanted to do. I always wanted to be a police officer. And so at about 15 and a half years old, here I go walking into the recruiting station with one of your former guests on the show, Dario Giomi, who was a recruiter at the time. And he goes, dude, get out of here. Like, you got to get out of here. You got to come back in a couple of years. And I'm like, no, man, like, I want to do this. And they used to do a split option to where you could go to basic training during your junior year. Then, you know, you drill on the weekends for your senior year. But I was too young because my birthday was in October. So I actually just ended up hanging around the recruiting station most of the time and then going to work. So I've known Dario for over 20 years and have formed a really good relationship with him. And it was great. So I ended up joining the Army in June of 2007, went off to basic training. And my first taste of reality, I will say my mom's father served in World War II, but he never talked about it. And he passed away before I joined the Army, and I never got the opportunity to talk to him about it. And my dad's dad told me, hey, you're going to leave here a boy, and you're going to come back a man. And I was like, okay, like, who's this guy now, right? And I remember showing up to reception there, and man, the smell of shaving cream and, you know, toothpaste, I'll never forget it. And I was like, I don't want to be here. And I remember going downstairs, my first introduction to the Army, being there. I was like, hey, drill sergeant, I don't think this is for me. And he looked at me, and his exact words were, do you think that all those people who died in the Twin Towers, you think that they wanted to be there that day? I don't think so. Get back in formation. And I was like, oh, man. So that was my introduction to the Army. And there I went, man. I thought I was good. I told my wife, my girlfriend, now my wife at the time, I said, hey, I'm going to do 3 years and get out. And here we are. It's been a great ride. We've lived all over the U.S. Yeah, I did some time in the reconnaissance world, and decided to try out for special operations. Was successful in doing that. Served doing that for a while, and then I had the opportunity to go earn a commission. Did that, and then came back to the special operations community where I'm at now. And I'm, you know, I'm kind of coming to the tail end of my road here, and it's been a great ride. I wouldn't have changed it for the world. It's been a lot of ups and downs, but I think it's been great, man. I think that's kind of what's driven me to look at what my next mission is going to be, you know?
Well, I do want to spend a little bit of time on, because the making you into the man, that's a constant evolution, within the military service. I was not, in the military, but having, law enforcement service, I feel like it's going to be somewhat similar in that growth process. But if I want to back up here, if you don't mind, ask you a couple of questions about your growing up. You made reference to addiction running rampant. What do you feel like was, do you feel like when going into the Army, you recognized the impact that had, were you aware of the impact that had played at the time? I'm confident you look back and reflect on it now and through a lot of growth, but did you see that connection or correlate that to where you were in life?
I did not. I did not recognize that at the time. I didn't even, at the time, I didn't even think I was ever running away from anything.
Yeah.
But one thing I did do is growing up, you know, and having my dad be like that at times, I learned to just do what made him happy. Right. Cause there was times he'd be physically abusive, verbally abusive. So just do what makes the man happy. And I carried that for a long time through my military career, which, you know, I didn't like confrontation. It goes into, and I think it, to your point, I think it took me a long time, a very long time to realize what does it mean in my own sense to be a man. Even after I got married, I don't think I fully understood what that meant or what that role was, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. So I look back at that and I carried a lot of that. Probably my first, 10 or 12 years in the military was just do what they want you to do so nobody gets mad at you. And it took me a long time to realize, and I'm even realizing it now, you know, looking back, like, dude, I think I was like inherently running away from things that I didn't want to face. Cause it's much easier to find like-minded people, right. And be strong. And I, you know, we'll dive into this too, but like what I deem as human performance is physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual fitness and self-leadership, which is arguably probably the hardest.
Sure.
And you can have one without the other, but you're probably going to be imbalanced. And I would say for years, I was extremely unbalanced because I went after the physical and mental toughness and forwent the emotional and spiritual one, because on the outside, people were like, and I'm sure you guys have experienced this, on the outside, guys were like, dude, that guy's a rock star, man. Like, I excelled through my career fairly well, right? I wasn't better than anybody else. I just did what they wanted me to do. But when I would get some constructive feedback or I got knocked down, dude, my emotional fitness wasn't there, because then immediately I went from 0 to 100. You know, and it just wasn't healthy.
Well, and Ben, you may have a thought on this, or if I'm interrupt, I thought I saw you getting ready to say something or ask something.
I'll let
you go if you would.
No, as you talk about it, we just finished up a group an hour ago talking about this, and it was about when was the first time you realized that you could lie and it would work? When you told someone that you were fine, and they actually believed you. And anyway, we've talked about how that kind of that belief shapes a lot of how we kind of make decisions and how we problem solve growing up. And as you talk about, just give them what they want. It's way less work. It's way less stress. It's way less conflict. I'll validate and take care of them and please them. And you know, secretly, I might kind of be bugged and a little resentful of you. But no, it's amazing how we all, independently all over the country, keep on learning these lessons pretty early on. Like just give them what they need, regardless of whatever cost might be.
I wonder too, if it wasn't a form of, and this is a question, not a statement of observation at all. It's more of a question, inquiry. I wonder too, if it wasn't a little bit of self-punishment of you know, whatever involvement you had or didn't have in that childhood, or dare say lack of healthy childhood, entering into you know, an area of the military that is elite, and forcing and pushing yourself in this manner to just say, I'm going to be the best no matter what.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that starts with self-confidence too, a lot of which I didn't have. You know, I did the things people wanted me to do, so I would get promoted. I'd be in places of responsibility, and I, you know, was leading people. And I look back and I was like, man, I don't know if I was really as effective as I could have been at that time. And I always wanted to do something more, but the fear of failure and the fear of self-confidence was like, dude, I don't know. Right. Like, because then at work, especially the way I experience it, and times have changed now, but when you were really good at physical fitness, when you were really good at just doing your job, right? So like in the reconnaissance world, being able to do reconnaissance, being able to shoot, move, communicate, and medicate, man, you compile that up with physical fitness, man, you were crushing it. Like that, there was no answer. So they never want to let you go, right? So anytime you make a murmur of, hey, I want to go try out for something, especially organizations within the Army Special Operations community that do not need permission from your parent organization, right? Here comes the peanut gallery. Yeah. Oh, we can't lose you. You shouldn't do that, right? There's certain organizations that you do need permission and paperwork to do, right? And I'm not going to say people slow roll that, because some do, some don't. But man, when you really can go put a packet in and just walk across the street and say, hey, I'm going to give this a shot, it can really stir a pot. And one of the guys that's actually on our team, his bio's on the website, he went to the selection first and he came back and he came up to me and he was like, hey man, I made it. You need to go. And he was the guy that I truly was like, all right, man, well, I didn't even think like, well, if he could do it, I could do it. It was just like, well, he went. So let's just do this. I didn't know how to train for it. Right. I just went, kind of figured things out, and I went and I got selected. And that was like the first time I had gone to something. It was like, man, I feel like I actually accomplished something, you know, but I was still seeking that validation from people. Right. And even my own family. And I mean, for a long time, I'll reference my career, but even in my personal life, just because the military has been such a big part of my life is, you know, when my dad was still alive, right, when I'd call him or tell him these things, it was almost like I was trying to seek validation. And I never really got that. So it was like when you found that little niche of people that were, hey, man, you know, hey, man, you did it. Good job. You're like, oh, man, these are my people. Like, these are great. You know, that really started to change my outlook on things, you know?
Yeah. No, I there's so much of what you're saying resonates very deeply with me. And I found mine late in life having actually most of that was when I went through Chateau. I was a people pleaser. I was really good at it. And physically, I did really well. So I was a peacemaker, but I came from a healthy family, but I was an adopted kid. So I had things working against me right off the bat. But it really resonates with me that you learn as you grow or learn as you go. So your growth is ongoing through these various stages of what you're terming as a really physical side of it. But this growth that's happening inside of you, like selection, once you passed, is that the right term? Once you passed selection? Yeah. Once you pass selection, you look in the mirror and then what are you seeing? I mean, you already said, alluded to it. What, I mean, are you saying I've arrived or I'm not enough?
To be honest, I don't remember really what I just thought when they handed me the piece of paper. So I remember this, I sat down and they do what they call an out counseling. So they'll sit you down and they'll tell you what you did good at, where you didn't do so well and where you need improvement. It's like a bullseye. So he sits down, he goes, hey man, physical fitness, above average. Mathematics, above average. And I'm like, heck yeah. I'm like, all right, yeah, whatever.
Killing it.
You know, and I'm sitting there and then he goes, hey, reading and vocab, not so well. He's all, you're going to struggle in language. And I went, what does this guy even know, dude? He doesn't know nothing. Like, what do you mean struggle in language? I didn't know what I didn't know. Again, though, at that time, I didn't even think about emotional and spiritual fitness. All I was the recon grunt that was like, dude, be fit, be mentally strong, run through wall. Like, I'll be able to do anything. And I would say upon arriving at Fort Bragg for the qualification course, I got humbled very quickly. And I got humbled by the people that were around me. And as I went through the course, I got humbled in language because that guy was spot on. I was riding the struggle bus. I can't tell you how many Disney movies I watched in French trying to understand what was going on. I can't tell you how many times instructors said, you're not going to make it. And I was like, dude, this guy's right, man. He doesn't even know who I am anymore. And he's right. But I've never felt like I've arrived ever. I will say there's been times where I've told myself, where I've had to reel myself back in thinking I was better than I was. But showing up here, any special operation, and I'm sure it's the same in law enforcement, any special operations or special group that you go to, you're like, man, I think I'm doing pretty good. Until you show up and you realize that really it's just the top 10% of the department or the organization. And you're like, oh, wow, like this is a whole new playing field. I remember looking around being like, oh, man, like nobody's ever going to beat me at anything, and getting mollywopped on a lot and being like, okay, like, you know, and then you just further that, you know, as you continue training. And then when you graduate, it doesn't stop. Even at graduating, I didn't think I ever made it because I was, man, wait till I get to my team, what that's going to be like. And I was so fortunate that I walked into an organization on the first day, and it was some of the guys I went to the course with, but I was standing among giants, and I quickly was humbled again on, hey, how do I even fit into this cog? But I will say, I believe that that's where I think my journey kind of began to figuring out what I needed to work on and really self-development.
Sure.
Chad, I got a quick question about that, because this moment when you recognize that you're among giants, I think as men, there's a bit of a challenge at times. We get pretty nervous about, yeah, the competition. And I'd love later on the chat about how your definition of being a man has evolved over the years. But as you talk about that, I think there is a certain acceptance that someone needs to be decent at to recognize that other people are they can still admire them and be humbled. But I think there's a couple of little mechanical pieces about what it takes to be in a mindset where you're willing to be humbled and recognize that, man, I didn't have what I thought I had. I wasn't where I thought I was. I'm curious if there's any particular idea that you could share that helped you get ready to accept something like that.
I don't know if there's nothing that stands out that I could have been ready, because I internalized a lot of that. Mm. But I will say the first team sergeant that I had, he was from Africa, and he used like a lot of African proverbs when he would talk to things. And he sat me down. He was never a guy that would ever take all the successes, right? And he sat me down and he said, hey, everybody's like a flower. If I give you water and give you the opportunity to grow and the sunlight to shine, you're going to grow in your personal and your professional life. And at the time I was like, right? I was like, man, this sounds really, you know, sounds really soft. What do you mean? Like, what are we doing here?
I'm the nastiest flower.
Yeah. Yeah. But to have that and be in an environment where you were able to grow. And I think to answer your question, Ben, being around those giants, those people were always willing to inspire you through their actions. And I think that's what humbled me, is that they never asked me to do something that they wouldn't do themselves. And when they did it, they were better than me at it. So I was like, dude, I can't even write a de facto thing for me. And it was always to talk smack. And I'm like, I can't even talk smack to anybody here, because I just, it's not happening. But their ability to inspire and mentor me was huge, you know? And I think that's really what started that journey. And internally, I would say these things. I can't remember coming out and saying them. Maybe I did, but yeah.
For context, when you're standing there and this thought of I'm among giants, how old are you at that time?
26.
Yeah.
And I say that because, again, in the conventional force, if you can do your job really well and be physically fit, man, you're going to stand out really well, right? And that has really changed over time, I think. But then when you come here where everybody's language qualified, everybody's been to certain schools, everybody's physically fit, almost maxing, if not well over maxing their physical fitness tests, and anything else you can throw at them, like, that's just baseline. That's just for you to walk in the door. And there was one guy in particular, I won't say his name on here, but he was an older guy. He was in his late 30s, early 40s. And he was a guy that just, he had been in the army a while and he had really tamed down, right? It seemed like he was a prior infantry guy. He had gotten all that anger and stuff out of him already. And he was a guy that really took me under his wing, and he was way more physically fit than I was. He was really mentally tough. And anytime he'd always take me to the gym, he was always a guy that would like, hey, like really let me walk the walk with him. And I think that's when I kind of realized like, man, dude, guys like him are everywhere here. And if I could just, I mean, if I could just live up to be like him in my professional life, I feel like I would be so much better.
Yeah, I do want to point out that this is I think second or third time, I don't recall specifically, that we've had a conversation, and it's fascinating to hear the humbleness by which you talk. For some of our listeners, they're not going to see you're not going to see you in person. We're on video here and we can see each other, but for the listeners, there's just a humbleness about how you're describing the elite nature of what you're entering into, which I think is speaks volumes to actually the probably no small part about why you've grown so much in your journey as a human. But if I would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about deployments. So, and I know we want to get to beyond the track, and we leave a little space and time there. But so now you're among giants. What happens? We got five deployments headed in.
Oh yeah,
I know you up. Can't. I know you can't talk specifics and details.
No, that's okay. So I'll back up a little bit here. So my career was pretty interesting. So my first duty station, I was at what we'd call like a TRADOC, so a training installation, right? So they trained officers and they had a bunch of schools there. So I spent about a year and a half there, and I had some incredible people that were around, but I didn't get any mentorship. I was right out of basic training and I was like, oh man, we didn't really have to do PT, right? They were focused on training the future force. And that was like at the beginning of GWAT, right? So it was like, hey, we got to pump people out so we can get them out to the force. So I show up to my second unit, which was in Fort Carson, Colorado, and I immediately show up to a unit that was building. The unit that was supposed to be built upon this was actually at Fort Hood at the time, or Fort Cavazos now. They were deployed in Iraq. So 4th Brigade, 4th ID was deployed, and that's when Cop Keating happened. If you guys had seen the movie, it's where Clint Rushmira got the Medal of Honor. So prior to that happening, right, we were standing up this new unit. They came in and they said, hey, who has dwell time? So we had a lot of guys there who had deployed and they weren't able to go again. And they pulled all of us newbies in the side and they said, pick a number between 1 and 20. Some of y'all about to be going overseas. I was like, what the hell, right? Like, okay, sure. And they ended up, a few guys picked numbers, they ended up picking them. Those guys ended up going to Cop Keating at the time. And right before the overrun ended up happening. However, during that time, I was like on this ramp up, where I kept showing up, like not going. So anyway, I was only at Fort Carson for about a year, but I spent about 9 months in the field training. And right about the time where I could re-enlist, they just came down on orders to go to Afghanistan. And again, it was not an organization that I felt that I got a lot of like mentorship and stuff out of. That was very much, I did from some people, but that was very much during a time in the Army where it was like, oh, you haven't deployed yet? Don't worry, you'll get your baptism by fire. And you're like, okay, like, sure. So from there, I go to Hawaii. And I'm in Hawaii a complete year before we go to Afghanistan. And there's where I really saw like my first set of people that like really started pouring into me and kind of teaching me and really kind of teaching me the basics. So from there, I was there a year. We deployed to Afghanistan in 2011 to 2012. We were in the east side of the country. And we were the only platoon out of our troop that lived at a combat outpost. So you had everything from the Corngal Valley, everything down. And for the first 4 months of that deployment, nothing happened. It was fairly quiet. For the first 2 months, we would go back and forth. It's about an hour and a half drive up to the Afghan Uniform Police Station. And we would live up there for like a week. We'd have to buy ice and, you know, some food off of the economy. And guys that had deployed before, they had gone to Iraq and stuff. And they were like, man, I thought Afghanistan was supposed to be the Wild West and this and that. And so finally, we ended up moving into this COP. And we had generators, right? We were living like on our own within the Afghan people. At that time, they called it VSO, Village Stability Operations. So it was meant for U.S. forces to be living among the population to show that, hey, we're building resiliency. We're working alongside of our partners. So there was a lot of, there became a lot of anger and upsetness that, man, guys just weren't getting it on. And I'll remember the morning of, this is about 4 months in, there was a radio call over our satellite radio, and it was from our brigade commander. And he was talking to a unit that was up near the Korangal Valley. We were just south of them in Nangarhar. And he said, hey, these guys are troops in contact. I'm sending additional forces to go up there. The battalion commander, who's the highest ranking officer in a tactical size element, was injured. He was shot. And man, the guys in the platoon were huddled around this radio like, man, oh man, like nothing's happening. So anyway, that night they had said for months, if anything's going to happen, it's going to happen between 10:30 and 11 p.m. Something like that, right? And I'm like, okay, whatever. I'm in my little hut, this little tiny hut, and I'm watching Patton with four guys, the old Patton movie. I had just came off guard shift, and out of the middle of nowhere, I hear, boom, bop, 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 bop. And I was like, at first, right, you go through so much training and stuff first. I was like, I feel like I'm at NTC right now, right? Down in California. And I'm like, that's not right, right? Your brain just plays these weird tricks. Man, I throw my gear on, I open up the door, and I just see this flash. It was another RPG. I'm all, what the hell? Okay. So I run up to the tower, and I knew who was on guard because I just gotten off. And it was this guy we had. He was one of our SAW gunners. I'll call him Justin. And Justin's on guard, and I didn't hear him, right? There's no return fire going. And all the fire had just went silent. So back about an hour prior to this, I was on a foot patrol. And imagine a tower here and like the field, right? Probably 100 yards, right? Till some houses. And it's just crops right there. Well, anyway, I was on a patrol and I came around the backside, and an hour earlier they had stopped and said, hey, you need to get back. And something told me to come back the way you came. I could have easily been back in 5 minutes, just cut right across, come back. Well, long story short, that's where those guys were set up in an L-shaped ambush. And that's where they fired from. So who knows what would have happened. In my mind, it probably would have been like a Mexican standoff, and it would have been like, oh, well, I don't know what to do. But I run up to the tower. Justin's not shooting back. I thought he'd been shot, and I'm yelling at him. He goes, I'm right here. And this guy, the whole time, oh, I'm ready to get it on, you know? And I'm like, what happened, man? Oh, I don't know, man. It just, all this stuff was happening, and it came out here. And I'm like, all right. There were a few other things that happened, but that, I will say overall that deployment was not super kinetic compared to, you know, a lot of other things. And so we ended up coming home in 2012. They were on the patch chart. They thought I was going to come off to go back overseas. So I reenlisted to stay in Hawaii. My wife and I liked being there, and they got pulled off the patch chart. So that's when I decided, hey, I'm going to go try out for something else. One of the guys in my organization went and tried out. He said, hey man, you could do it. I said, okay. So I went and tried out, got picked up, went through the qualification course, and got to my team. Got to my team, was able to do some awesome training, and was very fortunate enough to do three deployments to three different countries, all in Africa. So completely different mission set. Those varied from going out and helping train the host nation in different, you know, whether it was tactics, techniques, whether it was like human rights type stuff. Also deploying to Chad. And so we deployed to Chad, deployed to Senegal, and deployed to Mauritania, doing a litany of different things that were there, right? Really building host nation capacity and having the U.S. face that's out there, really helping out with exercise support. And it just, you know, it was a great time. And I did that all the way until about late 2016, 2017, right until I got ready to go in commission. So I went and did some time. I had a packet in to try and do some other things. And a buddy of mine, who's actually part of the Beyond the Trek too, Mike Diaz, he said, hey man, you should put this packet in to go be an officer. And I was like, right. I've always worked with officers, but you only get one. And I'm like, and they come and go. So we used to call them summer help all the time. Summer help. They'll come and go. I'm like, I don't even know what they do, man. But all right. So we both put packets in. We both got picked up. And from there, I commissioned into the infantry branch. Throughout that time in ROTC, that's where I started realizing that I was having trouble. And I'll dive into a little bit of that, actually, because it's really, it kind of goes along with your guys' name of No One Fights Alone. So my entire career up to this point was successful in my eyes, right? Had deployed 4 times up to this, was hitting all the marks for promotion, had made a promotion to be a senior non-commissioned officer, and I go off to ROTC. And for people that don't know, ROTC is a really good program, but it's college kids. The Army does a very small select. The year I got picked up, me and Mike, there was less than 200 active duty people that could get picked up, stay active duty, and go to school. So in my mind, right, I'm like, heck yeah, dude, I'm going to go hang out. I'm going to enjoy it. So my wife and I chose to go back to Hawaii, and I went to school in Hawaii. Well, what I didn't realize at the time was my entire career up to this point, and I'm sure you guys can relate to this, is I was in all the text chains. I was in the emails. I was in the know. I was with these guys, right? And then all of a sudden, you leave, and you're not in that anymore. And it didn't bother me at first, but it quickly did, because as soon as I got here, I there was about three or four other active duty people that were around, none of which were combat arms. That's not a fault against them, but in my mindset at this time, I was like, that's who I relate with. There were nobody else who had served in the special operations community. So I started to feel almost alone. So I started reverting back to what I thought, right? Be physically and mentally fit. And not having that support system of work. And I, up to this point in my life, I had identified myself with work, right? Like my family had taken a back seat. I was chasing everything I could. And my wife was extremely supportive of it. I didn't realize it at the time because it was always just, well, hold on. You know, and I find myself even doing it now, but it was, hey, I just got to take this, right? One of the guys needs this or this or that. And that was all gone. So it was trying to find what was my purpose besides just going to school and being part of this. You're there for less than 2 years. So first year did my school, and then they had an internship in Europe where you were actually going to go work with a staff section. And the guys in this staff section were actually guys I had worked with before in the Special Operations Committee. So I kind of had an in. And I said, hey, cool, let's go ahead and apply for this. And my wife was like, what are you doing? Like, why are you going to leave right now, right? We're supposed to be at home. And I'm reverting back to what was comfortable to me. Well, I got to find a way to get back in it. I got to find a way. So I'm in Europe for like 3 months. And I fly my wife over, you know, and we're hanging out and we're having a, you know, good time. We went to Switzerland, got to check out some stuff. And this is kind of where this isn't the worst thing that's ever happened to me. But while I'm there, my wife goes back home. They had what they call a career starter loan through USAA. And at the time, I was not like financially responsible. Growing up, nobody taught me how to manage money. And coming through the Army, like they have certain things that they'll show you. Now they've gotten a lot better. But being arrogant and young, I was like, oh, I don't need that. What do you need that for? And I was always looking for, well, when I get promoted, right? When I make more money, I'll be able to solve this problem. So, you know, I had a motorcycle, I had the car, I had you have the things that my daughter was starting preschool. So life was just happening. And I wasn't making a ton of money. So I said, hey, if I just get this career starter loan, right? Like it's at 0%, I'll get it. We'll be in no debt. We'll pay that. And we'll be good to go. Well, it required a lieutenant, your program commander's signature. And all the guys I was with were like, oh, dude, my commander don't care. I just signed it. And I'm all, something tells me that's not right, man. And anyway, I signed it, submitted it, and I got kicked back. And I was like, that's a sign. That's a sign right there. But what did I do? I let peers influence me, right? And it goes back to what is being a man, right? Again, I don't think I had figured it out, right? A leader of character, right? Because I had identified myself with being this war fighter, physically, mentally tough, but I wasn't emotionally there. So when things started turning the tables on me, it was like, whoa, this isn't my fault. So I ended up resubmitting it, and I get a phone call. The bank had actually called the program, commander, because he was a member of the organization as well. And he's like, hey, man, like, I didn't realize at the time. And he said, hey, how's everything going? Oh, everything's fine. You know, family misses me, all this other stuff. Goes back to what you were saying, Ben, right? Or you just got done doing it. I'm sure. Fine. I'm fine. You know, just sucks being away from family. And that was kind of his probe, you know? And so the next day I get a phone call and they're like, hey, you know, we heard this happen. Did it happen? And I said, yeah, of course it happened. This is what I did. I feel like nobody cared about me. That emotional fitness, that emotional intelligence. And I'm like, I had sent some emails prior, you know, nobody, and they hadn't gotten back to me. No fault of theirs. They're busy. And so prior to coming back from Germany, he said, hey, I have to do what the Army says is black and white and give you a letter of intent to probably release you from this program. And in my mind, I'm like, dude, my career is about to be over, you know? So I come back and I start talking to him. He's like, hey, man, we're gonna have to look at out processing you. And I'm like, oh, man. And kind of people had kind of like heard the murmurs and stuff about it. And but what really got me is a lot of organizations, they have shirts specific for pride, unit pride, right?
Right.
And he was like, hey, man, while you're going through this process, you're not wearing that T-shirt. You're wearing a bland T-shirt. And I was like,
ouch.
Yeah. And here I am, right, with my arrogant self of looking around. And in these programs, you have captains and things like that. And like coming from a special operations community, these people, captains and stuff, like, you're team leaders. You know what I mean? I'm like, you guys don't even know, who are you talking to right now? You guys haven't done anything, being arrogant. Emotional fitness, emotional intelligence was just not there. So I went through this big, long process and I started fighting it, right? And it brought me down to a really dark place, because not only was I doing school, right? I was like also trying to find avenues of like, well, I'm going to get out of here then, right? Like, they don't understand me. I didn't have the support system because I wasn't in the text chains. I wasn't in, you know, the email chains. And I started drinking a lot. And, you know, my wife was there and she was supporting me. She was that was like the hardest person to tell. She was like, why did you do that? And I'm like, well, I'm just trying to take care of my family, right? Like, I'm trying to carry all the burden, you know? And she's like, no, right? Like, no. So thank God for the program commander that was there, because he closed his door and he's like, this is what they say I have to do, is I have to work on pushing you out of here. And then he said, but this is how you can save yourself, and kind of gave me that talk. So I called everybody that I had served with in the special operations community. And that was like the hardest thing, right? Again, you're standing among giants. You're standing among people that you look up to. And they thought, in my eyes, I thought, right, like, I'm no better than anybody else, but I thought I was decent. Okay. And like, these guys that I had served with on teams and things like that, I was like, dude, how am I going to tell them this, right? They're going to look at me and be like, screw that guy. I can't believe you did that. And that was my mentality. You know, it's like somebody who drinks and drives. Is it okay? Absolutely not. It's okay. Absolutely not. But things happen and people make mistakes. And man, I picked up the phone and I called these people, and every single person I called came to bat for me. And one of my old commanders was like, hey man, I'm going to tell you this. People will come to bat for you one time. And I was like, wow. And that started changing my perspective. So I had this big rebuttal packet. They all wrote letters. And like I said, this isn't the hardest thing I've ever been through, but it's because it was on public display. And I had to really get to learn myself, and then explain to my peers around me who didn't understand me, right? Didn't have the same shared experiences, how to really be humble and eat some humble pie. And
Jed, I got a quick question about that, Chad. What did you think the work was during that period? Because I think there's moments where we hear the word no. And as you're talking about, like, you haven't heard no a ton up to that point. That's the benefit of two families, right? Someone's going to probably tell you yes. And as you talk about excelling and doing well, and obviously success might feed the ego or any of those kinds of things, what did you think? What do you think was right in front of your face that you that you probably needed to work on, but you just couldn't see it?
Being vulnerable.
Okay.
Being vulnerable enough to say, hey, we don't all have to have the same experiences. You know what? I've heard people say this a lot recently. It's like, what is good enough? Right? You get a lot of people that I look up to, and some people look at it as like imposter syndrome. You look up to and you're like, man, I don't want to talk to that guy. He's done way more than I have. And I have people that tell that to me, man, I feel like I can't relate to you. You've done so much. Well, I got to learn to take my own advice, you know, and that's something I wasn't doing at that time. And during that time too, I had noticed it, and you know, when I was drinking and things like that, I had gone to do some walk-ins for some like outpatient, you know, like behavioral health stuff. And I got really waved off by like the docs. Like I walked in there, and I'll vividly remember I walked up to the counter this one time, and it was this very young person who was sitting there. And he was in the Army, and he was a receptionist. And I said, hey man, I need to do a walk-in today. Like I've never been at a point where I was ever going to harm myself, but anger is the one thing that I always turn to, you know. And I was like, hey, I got to see somebody. And he goes, well, what's it for? And I was like, that doesn't concern you. I was like, I'm here to see, I need to talk to the doc. He's like, well, I just need to know like what it's for. And I immediately would go from zero to hero. And there was a civilian lady who was sitting there, and I felt so bad for her after it happened. And I looked at both of them, and I was like, you want to know why people kill themselves at the VA? It's because of stuff like this. Don't ask these dumb questions. And I walked out. So what did I do there, right? Like my emotional intent, like I just wasn't, what was I doing? I wasn't vulnerable enough to say, hey man, like this is why. Like who gives a crap? Like what else anybody else hears? I'm there for me, nobody else. So as I'm going through this process, they were like, hey, you know, it's not really looking super great for you. And I said, well, fine. I want to talk to everybody I can in the chain. I said, I'll go down swinging. Why not? And I came in one day and for my meeting, and the program commander said, hey, man, you're not going to talk to the HMFIC, if you will. And my heart sank. I was like, man, I just let down everybody that I called now. And he grabbed my packet and he threw it in the trash. And he said, you have shown me that you've been able to row your boat the last few months. He's like, but if you screw this up, man, because I stuck my neck out for you, it's over. And I was like, wow. Like he showed me grace. And that is something I hadn't seen, because I had seen some of the most awesome people do great things. And they would get a DUI. And I'm not condoning anything at all, right? But I admit, like, we're all human and we all make mistakes. And I would watch these people burn, like, oh, hammer them, right? And I was like, dude, this guy just showed me grace. And that completely changed my vision on how I should lead, how I should talk to people. And man, that last probably 8 months I was there, I had to be very humble. Right. And it was like starting from the bottom, because then all these people, even though they were college kids, they were like, oh, you're that guy. You're the guy. Right. And you're like, man, I got to earn trust now. I got to learn how to work with a different type of people that just doesn't want to run through a wall all the time. And I think that I kind of started this journey, if you will, because I immediately was like, oh, well, I'll just go back to combat arms and I'll go back to special operations. I'll go back to what I know. And that point there completely changed me, because as I went forward and I went to my unit up at Fort Lewis, I had it ended up being the executive officer and the battalion commander were phenomenal. Like, I don't know what it is, but as I deployed to Korea with a group of guys, it was super awesome. And the commanders that I had at the time were like, hey, you have free reign to do what you want. That's essentially what it was. Like, I'm going to call it what it is. I didn't have to do any of the red tape, right? And I felt free. And through that time, when I came back from Korea, the battalion commander sat me down and he gave me this position. And he said, I don't know what it is about you, but you're able to get a large group of people to move in one direction. And that's something I haven't seen in a long time. And I think that is what sparked Beyond the Trek. Like, that's what sparked giving back. And I had realized at that moment that, hey, when I was in that deep, dark place, when I had been in denial about things of childhood trauma, how I had avoided confrontation, like, dude, I've never been alone, right? No one fights alone. Like, I've never been alone. I've had people that were willing to help. I just wasn't vulnerable enough, or, you know, I hate the term being man enough, but like, you know what I mean? I hadn't learned like, it's okay to say, hey, I'm here, man. Because you would be surprised at how many people, when you raise your hand, are going to say, hey, man, I feel just like that.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so.
I find it interesting. I do want to circle back to one point on the grace topic. I want to circle back to that in a second, but I love this concept, the story that you're unpacking here of the concept of no one fights alone. We are amongst, you know, in this warrior, first responder, veteran, active military space, you're among warriors, but yet at the time you don't realize some of the most difficult battles are between our ears, and the space between our head and our heart, you know, that, and we fight that alone a lot, and think that we're embodied, and surrounded by, people, but the reality is oftentimes we're not. But to back to that grace piece, when you were sitting there and realizing this kind of this moment of, holy shit, this is fixing to go away, and I'm getting something that I don't deserve, or I'm not getting something I do deserve, maybe, is, you know, in that grace space, how difficult was that to actually swallow and receive?
It was hard. And one of the things I completely skipped over is when I was in Germany and I decided to, you know, I kept saying nobody was helping me. A medic that I had that served right alongside me in Afghanistan had died of an overdose. One of the guys I had in my platoon had murdered his wife. I'd gone to their wedding. And one of the guys I was with in Germany that I knew was addicted to alcohol and tried to kill himself. And it was just these compounding things and like survivor's guilt. So while I had just spent so much time being angry and just running away and figuring out how I can be good on the outside, it was the first time that I felt like, when I felt that grace, I was like, do I even deserve this? Like, part of my arrogance was like, well, of course I deserve it. Like, look at what I've done. But then the other part of me was like, dude, the last few months, nobody else has humiliated yourself but you, because you decided to make a real dumb decision. This is your opportunity. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. People will tell you all the time, when you leave the military, when you leave law enforcement, when you leave anything, I don't care if you leave Amazon, you're going to leave with your family and your reputation. And hopefully you have both. And I was like, man, okay. But then I started thinking about it and I was like, who cares about my reputation, man? Like, at the end of the day, like, the people who I care about and the people who I've learned, served alongside and formed friendships with, they're going to be there. Do I really care about what the peanut gallery has to say about everything else? Because at the end of the day, at the end of this, when this whole road is over and I leave this earth, I have to answer for my actions. My reputation isn't going to matter. None of those people are going to be standing there with me going, no, man, he was good. He was this, he was that. Like, no. So I took that in and I sat there. I was crying in this guy's office and I was just like, wow. You know, I was so stressed and I felt like, this is your chance. Like, this is your second chance. Don't mess it up. And I truly believe it's because, like, I had a new mission. I had a new mission. And that mission was supposed to be go out and give grace back to people. Mm-hmm. Because when I went back to the force, right, there's a lot of legal issues in the conventional army. You just have a larger amount of people, right? Like, some organizations have 250 people in one company on a daily basis. So you can imagine, right? Everything between alcohol, drugs, I mean, everything. And there was a time, like I said, I just watched people get hammered. And you were just like, oh, well, hey, whatever. You decided to make that decision, dummy. And I went into this with a whole new perspective. And I started asking the why. You know, hey, why did so-and-so decide to drink and go run through the park? Well, he decided to run through because his wife just had a miscarriage and he didn't tell anybody. Okay, well, like, yeah, he messed up, man. Like, he got arrested. But maybe he needs a little bit more help instead of just let's just bury him, right? And like I said, that just really gave me the passion, the drive to start creating Beyond the Trek without even knowing it. And while I had the opportunity and the free reign to kind of do what I wanted, I started creating these physical challenges because people would come up to me and be like, hey, I know Brad does the paperwork and Ben's the, you know, the guy that gets me all my comms, but they won't do it for me. I don't know what's going on. Well, do you know who to talk to exactly? No, I don't. Perfect. Well, then this month we're going to do a workout. I'm bringing Brad and Ben both in and you're going to meet them. So now you can go solve your own problem. And it was received with a lot of pushback at the beginning. And after about the third one, I started getting so many people to sign up and do these things. And at the end of like formations and stuff, right on a weekend, everybody wants to get out. They don't want to hear anybody else talk when you get to it. And I found myself like coming up with these phrases and I would sit there and I would talk to people like normal people. And I took a lot of the things I had learned in special operations and I got rid of rank. And I wanted to get to know people for people. And I wanted to give that grace, you know, because you see guys grinding and working, being there early, staying late. And they don't ever, a lot of times guys don't, they don't ever get, I mean, gals too, right? I'm kind of lumping that in, but they don't always get that thank you. They don't always get that, hey, how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing fine. No. How are you really doing? Well, I'm not doing well, actually. You know? Okay, why? And getting them to be vulnerable and open up with you. And that kind of started the journey. And that's where I think I started to birth this thing, you know?
I had a quick follow-up because you're talking about this moment that I think is great. And it's this moment where we're right up to the edge, kind of a ledge basically, of we get a piece of feedback, something humble us, something triggers potentially a pretty educational moment for us. And you talked about the grace part of it. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts for our listeners about what happens when, I guess a different way of talking about it would be your ego is bruised. And for some of us, when our ego is bruised, we're trying to figure out how to come back swinging and to prove how strong we are and to not take that invitation that you're talking about of being vulnerable and staying vulnerable. I think there's a lot of moments where people get humbled and they are motivated to move out of that moment, not stay there. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about, and maybe I think you've hit on a couple of pieces that are in that realm, but I'm curious, what would be your advice for those who are getting the shit kicked out of them? And in that moment, no doubt is an invitation for change. Something's got to be different.
So
how would you instruct them to hang in there and to stay humble as opposed to come back swinging with the ego?
It's funny you say that, cause that's pretty much, that is where this name derives from, is we all go through this difficult trek, whether it's success, failure, no matter what it is. But that success or failure is never going to define who you are. You need to remember how you got there, why you got there. And what are you going to do with those lessons learned beyond that moment and be able to give it back? So the advice I would give somebody is, if you're getting the shit kicked out of you, why are you? Was it your failure to plan, right? Did you plan to fail? What were all the factors going into this? Okay. It can't always be a woe is me. And it's going to end eventually. But what can you learn from this to be able to give back to others? And I saw this quote today that I think is that hits on this. And it was, you grew up to be the adult that would have protected you as a child. And I think of that, and it goes back to well, if you're getting beat down and stuff a lot, what have you learned from that? What can you implement and change in your life in the future when you get through this, because you will, to give it to somebody else? Somebody else is living your story. So you can just say, hey man, I got to put one foot in front of the other. That's all I got to do. Eventually this is going to end.
Yeah. And the courage that goes along with that. I think there's moments where a younger definition of being a man didn't include that kind of courage. It was in a different area, but the courage to stay there and kind of looking in that mirror and saying, here's the nasty truth of the good and bad and ugly about me. And that's okay too. But the courage to keep on looking and asking those tough questions, I think that's something that most of our dads didn't pull us aside and give us a heads up. But we have to bump into people in our path to do that.
Yeah. And I think we look at generational change. Everything's going to change. It's always going to change, right? And previous generations, especially for the military, go, things have gotten soft. It's harder when I was in. Okay. And our parents, right? They handled things in a certain way. And growing up the way I did, and for a lot of people, you look at that and you don't necessarily say, I'm taking all the great things that they did, I'm going to implement. I'm also going to implement the things I didn't like. So growing up as a kid, getting beaten down with, you know, words and hands and things, that is something I've carried with me. And I've told myself throughout my life, I will not do that with my kids. I will not do that along my journey.
Hey Chad, let's transition to this Beyond the Track. You kind of segued us in there. And as we kind of, I want to make sure we carve out time to talk about this. This is your passion and your mission. So what is Beyond the Track?
So Beyond the Track now, what it is, right? What has it evolved into is an organization that we're building that forges leaders of discipline, resiliency, and trust. And we're focused on shaping a future built on strength, character, and unyielding integrity. It is based on what we like to call the human performance and leadership development aspect, developing people physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, work on your self leadership. And the five, we have three values and five phrases that we really try to live by each and every day. Those three values are discipline, resilience, and leadership, right? Discipline's the thing that's going to kind of get you through each and every day, whether you want to do it or not, which is going to build the resilience. So when life does come, right, and kick you in the teeth, you're going to be able to bounce back. And that self-leadership piece, right, you're going to get developed to that through discipline and through the resilience that you're able to grow, which is going to lead you into the five phrases for what we have. And the first one being is attitude. You got to look at everything with an attitude, right? Attitude is what changes. It is what most people have done things in their life. They're going to complain about it. But when they get on the other side of it, it wasn't as bad as they thought. So I always challenge people to try and go in through things and have a positive attitude, right? Just have a good outlook on it. All right. The second thing is be the leader you would follow. At the end of the day, I tell people all the time, man, it sounds cheesy. Pull your iPhone up, go look at a camera, look at yourself and ask yourself, would I follow me? Physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, financially, whatever. You can put whatever label you want. And if you answer no, then that means you already know what you got to work on, man. Would I want to be my own father, my own brother, my own husband, my own friend? Do you have higher standards for other people than you do yourself? And it's crazy when I ask that question, and I commend people when I ask that, and I get two or three hands that go up because, excuse my French, I look across the room and I go, half you people are bullshitting right now. Cause I know most of you are like, oh yeah, I expect him to do that, but there's no way I would do that. Like, okay, it goes back to what we've talked about. You've never arrived. I don't care what success you've had. I don't care what you've done. That was yesterday. That's not today. So attitude, be the leader you would follow. Third one, be the change you wish to see, which goes back to what I said about growing up. Right? I know that the things that I saw in my family, I didn't want for my kids, so I'm not going to implement them. I'm not going to do it. And it's okay. It's okay to have generational change, because if everybody stays the same, we got a problem.
Right?
The fourth one is do something hard every day. I don't care. I tell people that it doesn't have to be physical, right? You don't got to go out and run 10 miles. It could be as something as, hey, I haven't talked to my sister in 6 months, or I haven't talked to my kids in a year. Okay. Well, your hard today should be to pick up the phone and call them. Right. And I love saying that to people, because there's so many people that'll be like, well, I'll go run 10 miles. Okay. Why don't you pick up the phone? Oh, well, that's too hard. Why? You're going to tell somebody else to do it. You should probably take your own advice. And then the last phrase, which I try and do each and every day, is find something to have fun with. Life's short, right? The average lifespan of a male in America is like 76. For females, like 78. Find something every day to have fun with. And an exercise I tell people to do is write from 1 to 100 on a piece of paper. Tear off the age that you are up at top. Okay. And then tear off the average lifespan of, right, male or female. You usually end up with about that much paper left. And you're like, that's all you got left. That's it. So what do you want to do with the rest of your time here to make an impact on other people, right? And leave this place a better place, or, you know, better than you found it. So that was a long-winded answer to say Beyond the Trek is focused on giving back of lessons learned, developing people, and just sharing our experiences.
That's amazing, Chad. If somebody wanted to get connected with Beyond the Trek to find out more, how they can actually get connected with you, how they can learn more about your program, where would they find your information?
So we are on, we have a website, Beyond the Trek, TREK.co. We are on Instagram, we're on Facebook, we're on YouTube. We just recently started a podcast fireside chat series, which you guys will be guests on here, hopefully shortly. Sweet. As well. And that is on Apple, it's on Spotify, and it's on YouTube as well. But on our website, you can go in there and go to the Contact Us page. On the website, there's services. And just feel free to reach out. I tell people all the time, man, reach out on social media. Like, if you're like, hey, I'm struggling, I want to know more about it, everybody on our team has access to the social media page, man. We will get back to you.
That's cool. And I also wanted to highlight one of the posts that actually February, and I'm not sure when we'll release this, but I do want to put it in here and put a plug in. I pushed it on our social media, but February, you did a challenge in February, which is, let me get it right. It's mental, emotional, spiritual resiliency challenge of identifying or removing, what is holding you back. What a fascinating challenge.
Yeah. And I urge people to go there. We do a fitness challenge every month. We're always looking for organizations to want, or individuals to want to sponsor one. And it's anything that has to do with physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually challenging. And, you know, if you go on there, you'll see it. And the basic rundown was it of identify what it is and tell yourself it's got to go.
Hmm. Ben, anything?
No, it's great. I love the concepts you just walked through. I think they relate a ton with what we've developed as a program. And yeah, it's like you were having the same thoughts we were over the years about some of this stuff. I can't say enough about what it means to families as well as individuals to be that leader and to be a clear teacher about what self-leadership means to you. I think that yeah, I love the concept, love all of it. Loved hearing the behind the scenes of how it came together. Really appreciate you making some time for us.
No, thank you guys.
Chad, happy birthday to your daughter. Go enjoy your birthday with your daughter, and happy Valentine's to you and your wife. I hope you guys have a great Valentine's Day, and thank you so much for coming on the No One Fights Alone podcast. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, guys.
Yep. See you, man.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's first responder resiliency program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.